Well, good morning and welcome to our 1045 session entitled Robert George on Natural Law, Commonalities and Differences. My name is Walton Padelford. I'm from the business school here at Union. It's my pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. David Novak, who holds the J. Richard and Dorothy Schiff Chair of Jewish Studies. He's professor of the study of religion and professor of philosophy at University of Toronto since 1997. He received Bachelor of Arts degree from University of Chicago in 1961, Master of Hebrew Literature degree in 1964, and his rabbinical diploma in 1966 from Jewish Theological Seminary of America. He received PhD in philosophy from Georgetown University in 1971. Professor Novak is author of several books, the latest being The Jewish Social Contract, an essay in political theology. His book, Covenantal Rights, A Study in Jewish Political Theory, won the award of the American Academy of Religion for Best Book in Constructive Religious Thought in 2000. His latest book is In Defense of Religious Liberty, published by Intercollegiate Studies Institute. He is author of over 200 articles in scholarly and intellectual journals. I do see that Dr. Novak's books are available out front for purchase. I was going to give you an address for Intercollegiate Studies Institute and a special internet deal for $14.40 on In Defense of Religious Liberty, but the book's available here, so you may not need that address. Our discussant for this session is Dr. Patrick Lee, who is John N. and Jamie D. McAleer Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Institute of Bioethics at Franciscan University in Steubenville. Dr. Lee received doctorate from Marquette University and is author of over 40 articles or chapters in books or journal articles. He is author of Abortion and Unborn Human Life, published by Catholic University Press. He is co-author with Robert George of Body, Self, Dualism, and Contemporary Ethics and Politics from Cambridge University Press. He is also a much sought-after speaker, with several events happening from Princeton University to Fordham to Valparaiso. He writes for general public audiences and outlets such as National Review Online, The New Atlantis, and Public Discourse. After these presentations, we will have a short question and answer session, which I will introduce to you when Dr. Lee is finished with his remarks. And I'll tell you more briefly about Q&A when we're done. So, please welcome Dr. David Novak.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here for the first time, and especially last evening to hear the truly inspiring story of how, if not resurrected, this university certainly was saved from very serious and debilitating illness and tragedy. So it's a special pleasure to be here for that reason. Part one of the paper is entitled Disagreement, Theoretical and Practical. We've come together here and now to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the publication of Making Men Moral, a brilliant book by our colleague, our teacher, and above all, our enlightened and enlightening friend, Robert George. This book engages in what the German Jewish philosopher Hermann Cohn called Theorie der Praxis. It is a work that connects the theoretical and the practical in the realm of distinctly human action. It shows how praxis without theory is blind and theory without praxis is empty. Professor George's book makes that connection by showing how a theoretical perspective enables us to understand how and why authentically human action differs from the behavior of other animals and from the creative acts of God. By so doing, Professor George has carved out a road for himself that differs from the pure theory of metaphysics, which, for someone following in the footsteps of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, deals with superhuman activity. And this theoretical praxis or practically significant theory also differs from the philosophically obtuse approach of many lawyers and even judges, one that rhetorically shuffles a body of norms for all sorts of disparate pragmatic purposes, rather than searching for the moral principles that underlie these norms, thus giving them their true intelligibility, by indicating how these norms intend the good which is to be done. Bonum est faciendum est resequendum, as Thomas Aquinas famously put it. Therefore, we might best call Professor George's work a work of practical reasoning. Professor George's kind of practical reasoning is clearly distinct from the type of ethical theory that cannot justify specific norms. Indeed, Hans Kelsen, probably the greatest of the legal positivists, had this kind of ethical theory in mind when he argued against basing law on morality, because for him, all ethical theory is similarly vague and subjective. Hence, for Kelsen, ethics is insufficient to ground law, lacking as it does law's rigor and objectivity. Moreover, Professor George's practical reasoning is just as clearly distinct from the type of shallow legal manipulation of norms and precedents that does not employ theory or see the need for theory at all, and which frequently dismisses those who even suggest the possibility of ethical theory, let alone the need for it in legal judgment. Unlike Professor George, who has an ethical theory to bring to legal questions, those who see positive law being an autonomous realm unto itself cannot answer the moral questions, why should I obey a law or a body of law, and to what end should anyone make a law or rule on a point of law? It seems that these legal positivists, who are inevitably moral relativists as well, cannot answer these obvious questions. Again, unlike Professor George, they have badly coordinated their theoretical and practical concerns, or they have not done so at all. Moreover, their unfortunate habit of dismissing any question to which they do not have a ready answer as a pseudo-question, a holdover from the logical positivists of yore, is something no philosopher should be allowed to get away with. Any question that can be posed intelligently deserves to be examined with at least equal intelligence. And as the Talmud puts it, when one cannot answer such a question, one should be honest enough and humble enough to say, I don't know, which implies there might be a good answer to the question from somebody else. That is, if one has not already ruled out a possible answer from anybody. It would seem that Professor George would have three kinds of colleagues in this overall project of practical reasoning. One, there are those here and elsewhere who share both Professor George's practical commitments to such things as the prohibition of the killing of innocent human life at whatever stage of its development, and his theoretical perspective that positive law is essentially enacted in order to facilitate the instantiation of what Professor George, following and critically developing the theory of Germain Griset, especially as followed and critically developed by his teacher John Finnis, has often called basic human goods. Two, though it is hard to imagine, there is a possibility that there are those who would agree with Professor George's theory, yet differ with him on how it actually justifies at least some of the practical norms he espouses. Here I think of the difference between Germain Griset and John Finnis on the practical question of capital punishment, Professor Griset being opposed to it in any circumstance, Professor Finnis being in favor of it at least some circumstances. Just as an aside, Germain Griset was my Dr. Vater, and John Finnis, of course, is Robbie George's Dr. Vater. So it's an interesting development of differences and agreements. Three, then there are those who would agree with Professor George's practical stand, especially on the inviolability of all innocent human life, it's the best example, yet who would differ with him on a number of his theoretical positions in ethics, even those he uses to inform his practical stands. And truth be told, I put myself in this third category. And finally, there are those who basically disagree with Professor George on both the theoretical and practical level. And even though he is willing and able to civilly engage them in public discourse, especially at Princeton, at a conference like this, we can relieve him and ourselves of the burden of having to argue with those whom Robbie George sometimes calls, verbally rather than in writing, the bad guys. As we so often have to do, that is arguing with those with whom we share neither theoretical nor practical commonality. Conversely, even when we do have theoretical differences among ourselves, we are still able to speak the same philosophical language together. Thus, we can still talk about truth, right, good, justice, obligation. In fact, we can even talk about God. If not at the level of revealed theology, then still at the level of philosophical ethics. Such a setting for this kind of inner familial discourse, as we have here today, is alas a luxury rather than a commonplace for most of us. So let's enjoy it and make good use of it while it lasts. The question before us now, after this initial confession of mine, is, how can theoretical difference not lead to practical difference? Or, how can practical agreement not come from theoretical agreement? Nevertheless, if practical agreement can be reached without theoretical agreement, even in spite of theoretical disagreement, then how do we get ourselves out of the conclusion that theory is only a rationalization of praxis, and the correct morality, what we could call orthopraxis, being the primary phenomenon, doesn't really need theory, orthodoxy, which is, after all, only an epiphenomenon? Indeed, aren't we at times tempted to think that concern for practical theory is a diversion from the type of pragmatic immediacy that seems to make moral action most effective? Now, one need not be a Marxist to sometimes agree with Marx that our task as political activists, that Professor George and some of us are, is not to understand the world, but to change it. Or, as we so often heard from our recently departed teacher and lamented friend, Father Richard John Newhouse, who was originally scheduled to be with us in this conference, isn't our primary moral political task, our work in the world, as Newhouse would put it, to turn this thing around? And to do this well, aren't good moral instincts and good moral experiences enough? Aren't instinct and experience all we need to act effectively in the world? However, I know that neither Professor George nor I, nor most of you here today, would want to leave the question of the connection of the theoretical and the practical in ethics at a level where theory becomes quite peripheral after all. No, praxis and theory are both done by mindful bodies, embodied minds. Praxis is not done by the body without the thoughtful mind. Theory is not done by the mind without the acting body. On that point of philosophical anthropology, Professor George and most of us here today are more Aristotelian in our outlook than we are, let us say, Platonists or Cartesians. Therefore, we must pursue the indispensable need for any one thinker or school of thought to correlate theory and praxis, but still not succumb to the temptation to require that practical agreement must presuppose total theoretical agreement. Now, I first learned of the importance of the connection of theory and practice in ethics in my ongoing study of the traditional discourse of the Talmud and the logical issues that continually appear there. But let me assure you that these logical issues, as well as most of the ethical issues, are not only internal matters of concern for Jewish theology alone. Rather, one can see these logical and ethical issues operating in other traditions too. That notwithstanding, though, one understands something best when he looks again at the sources wherefrom he first discovered it, especially if those are the sources to which he returns again and again to nurture heart and mind. Yet since these issues are not confined to these sources, my reexamination of them with you today should be readily intelligible. Now, there are times when the Talmud reports two opposing decisions, what it calls a machloket, regarding practice. Rabbi A decides X is to be done. Rabbi B decides X is not to be done. Then the anonymous compiler of the final version of the text asks the question, what theoretical difference of opinion, in Aramaic, b'maika mipalge, does this practical opposition presuppose? On the other hand, there are times when the Talmud reports a theoretical difference of opinion. Rabbi A opines, savar, P is Q. Rabbi B opines, P is not Q. Then the anonymous compiler of the final version of the text asks the question, what difference in actual practice is entailed by this theoretical difference of opinion, my beinayhu in Aramaic? The implication of both of these questions is that a practical dispute without a theoretical dispute underlying it must be accidental rather than essential, and that a theoretical dispute without a practical dispute resulting from it is only a semantic distinction without a real difference. Nevertheless, since neither Professor George nor I regard our practical agreements to be accidental rather than essential, and since neither of us regards our theoretical disagreements to be merely semantic, I want to find a way in this lecture to preserve our agreements, respect our disagreements, and show how this can be done consistently and persuasively. Part two, theoretical divergence. We now need to look at how Professor George and I diverge theoretically, especially in how we diverge in our interrelation of the concepts of good and right and our respective views of what practical reason or ethics is meant to do. In Making Men Moral, Professor George writes as follows, quote, "Authenticity and other basic goods are powerfully served by individual liberty and autonomy. This natural law theory of individual rights and collective interests has the advantage of providing a rational account of the moral foundations of rights by understanding them as implications of intrinsic human goods and basic moral principles which rationally guide and structure human choosing in respect of such goods. Moral rights are constituents of the common good," close quote. In my book, Covenantal Rights, published 7 years after the making of Making Men Moral, the following assertion is made, quote, "Good seems to many to be a more basic moral term than right. Either in the classical sense, it is right to do that, or in the modern sense, he or she has a right to do that. Nevertheless, it is still insufficient to structure morality. For goods are neither states of being from which persons derive norms, much less states of being generated by the human will. Instead, they are the measures of how adequate to the nature of the claimant and the respondent, between whom the claim operates, that claim really is." In my view, rights are claims, justified claims made of which there are justified responses called duties. "Hence, these claims or rights are the true criteria of justice. Justice is the order of rights, is the more basic ethical political term than good or the good. The proper fulfillment of a right is what is good. That is, the duty elicited by the right has been done well. The good to be done for someone is for the sake of the one who holds the right, who makes the claim. The justice of the claim is what makes the content of the claim good." Close quote. When looking at these two divergent views of the relation of good and right, it is important to notice that Professor George and I are using the same vocabulary. So even though the conceptual difference is obvious, if it were more divergent than it is in fact, we would have lost a common language of discourse. That could easily happen if we were not only using different terms, but if there was no correspondence between the terms he uses and the terms I use, or if each of us rejected altogether the terms used by the other. But to the contrary, our conceptual difference is in the way we order the same terms differently, yet without eliminating any of them. And since languages are essentially social practices that function within communities of discourse, as Wittgenstein taught us, and this is especially the case with normative languages, as Alistair MacIntyre has taught us, the fact that Professor George and I can use virtually the exact same terms, albeit in different ways, means that we are still within one discursive community. One could say, in a more Aristotelian way, that our theories have generic commonality and only specific difference. Indeed, this reminds me of the way Aristotle, in the beginning of the Politics, assumes that we are communal beings because we are linguistic beings, just as we are linguistic beings because we are communal beings. Thus, language and commonality and community are two sides of the same coin. Accordingly, it could be said that Professor George and I are both neo-Aristotelians, broadly speaking, in the way we conduct philosophical discourse. These points should be kept in mind when we return to the question of theory. Part three, practical commonality. When it comes to our practical commonality, especially on the question of the inviolability of all innocent human life, it is important to ponder, did Professor George and I come to that practical agreement because of our respective ethical theories? Or did our respective ethical theories result from our respective retrospection as to what makes our practical commitments intelligent choices rather than blind obedience? Here again, Aristotle is helpful when early in the Nicomachean Ethics he says, quote, We must not overlook the difference that it makes whether we argue from or to first principles, apoton archein or epitas archas. Thus, as on a racetrack, they run either from the judge's stand to the far end or in the reverse direction. We must start from what is known, from what is known to us. If anyone wants to make a serious study of ethics or of political science generally, he must have been well trained in his habits. Close quote. Now, one could say, glossing Aristotle with Kant, that our discovery of moral principles is very much done in the way Kant saw our discovery of the a priori conditions that make experience possible, like our intuitions of time and space. Thus, we do not first become aware of time and space and then apply them as categories to data subsequently given or put forth in our experience. Instead, after having had enough experience to stimulate us to think of the conditions that made that experience possible, we try to constitute what these enabling conditions truly are. Regarding moral experience, which is best obtained in traditional communities that take imperatives like thou shalt not murder to be categorical, it is only after we have been, as Aristotle put it, well trained in our habits that we can be sufficiently stimulated intellectually to discover what made the proscription of such evil acts possible. Surely that happens when we discover the reason for which, that is why, this norm was put forth in the first place. And for the inherence of religions of revelation like Judaism and Christianity, that means discerning what is God's reason for prohibiting the shedding of innocent human blood, which then becomes a reason any rational person can identify with. When that happens, the Talmud says we become God's partners in the work of creation. Accordingly, our moral experience is chronologically prior to our moral reasoning, whereas our moral reasoning is logically prior to our moral experience. Now, we learn from biblical revelation that God's reasoning is both logically and chronologically prior to the norms God alone could create ex nihilo. Thus, the prophet states, "For my deliberations, machshavotai, are not your deliberations," Isaiah 55:9. And furthermore on this point, even though Kant seemed to have invested the autonomous moral agent with godlike authority, he nonetheless did not give this autonomous creature the power to make new moral norms, norms which would be contrary to the norms Kant learned from the Judeo-Christian morality taught him by his parents as transmitters of their and then his historical culture. Indeed, at the beginning of the Critique of Practical Reason, Kant assures his readers that he is only providing a better rationale for a practical morality that could be readily recognized already. As such, he is pouring old wine into new bottles rather than providing a radical new vintage from an untested vineyard. One should thus contrast Kant's moral conservatism with Nietzsche's rejection of the Judeo-Christian moral tradition when he proclaimed a transvaluation of values. It is clear that Professor George and I came to practice first when we engaged in theoretical reflection, and we then brought some of the fruits of that reflection back to the practical judgments we have tried to make in the political realm, each in his own way. So when it comes to the human life questions that have concerned us both, but in which a professional like Professor George has had much greater impact than an amateur like me has had, it is clear we were taught reverence for human life within the respective traditions we grew up in. From earliest childhood, we saw the ritual practices of our respective Catholic and Jewish traditions that welcome new life into the world, care for it during its journey through the world, and mourn the passing of old life from the world. These traditions recognize human life as a unique and precious gift from the Creator and Lord of all life, who is especially concerned with the human life created in his image and likeness from conception to death and beyond in a way unknown to us in this world. Thus, we were both well trained in the habits that Aristotle saw as being the necessary precondition for ethical reflection, for the théorie de praxis which Hermann Cohen struggled to constitute. That is why each of us was bewildered, even shocked, when we entered the secular worlds of the university and public affairs and found people who had either been deprived of a true culture of life altogether in childhood, or had thrown behind themselves any such culture, who looked upon human life as some sort of commodity, either a commodity to be discarded as a worthless burden, or a commodity to be pursued irrespective of how that single-minded pursuit might violate other rights or other goods. In fact, I suspect that our initial bewilderment or shock at what we found out there. May each of us realize that we had to do some hard thinking about the principles that this culture of death, to use the apt term of the late Pope John Paul II, had ignored or foregone, so that we could argue for a culture of life intelligently, even with our own people, let alone with others. Contrary to the view of the late John Rawls, neither Professor George nor I came to democratic polity, whether academic or governmental, from behind a veil of ignorance before our eyes, as if, in the apt title of Thomas Nagel's book, ours were a view from nowhere. We were not like the jurors who've been told by a judge who, after hearing an argument he doesn't like, the jurors will disregard what you have heard. The judge knowing full well that no one can choose to forget anything of significance he or she has heard or experienced. In fact, we would agree with Alistair MacIntyre that only contemporary liberals have the chutzpah, that's a Hebrew and then Yiddish word for colossal nerve. To presume that everyone but themselves comes from a tradition, and that they alone are able to dictate the terms of public discourse and action, because everyone but themselves is too prejudiced to be truly universal in outlook to do that intelligently and objectively. Neither Professor George nor I have ever accepted the liberal myth that culture, along with the traditional moral praxis inherent in it, can be created by human design ab initio rather than being inherited post factum. And once one realizes the true limits of human invention, one begins to think through one's culture de novo, especially its universally significant moral content, that aspect of one's historical culture that readily speaks to all rational, morally earnest, that is, decent human beings. Indeed, it is because of that moral bridge between historical culture and secular society that we have been able to belie the simplistic dichotomy that limits one's locus in the world to either the naked public square or to a ghetto. Four. Reasons are not rationalizations. Now, if our moral positions are not constructs but inheritances, we then need to answer the charge that our respective ethical theories are nothing but rationalizations of our respective moral theologies. Neither Professor George nor myself nor most of you here today are the intellectual equivalents of the Monday morning quarterback, that is, someone who claims to have known beforehand what he has only retrojected after the fact. Now, the term rationalization usually means giving an irrelevant or superficial reason for doing what one is doing. For example, it would be a rationalization if I were to say that the reason for my leaving this conference tomorrow on Friday morning, so as to be able to arrive in Chicago before dark to celebrate the Sabbath with my family in Chicago, it would be a rationalization if I said that this is because it is needed to maintain our family's unity. That might very well be a good result of what I plan to be doing tomorrow, but it does not give the true reason for what I plan to do tomorrow. Instead, the true reason is that God has commanded me and all other Jews to celebrate the Sabbath on the seventh day so that we might experience covenantal intimacy with our Creator, whose work we cannot imitate, but whose reflective enjoyment of his work we can celebrate with him as our God. And the best way to do that, when at all possible, is with one's family in the setting of a traditional Jewish community. Now, a sociological explanation like the one just mentioned above, family unity, sounds like the 1950s slogan, "The family that prays together stays together," which might well be true when one compares the greater rates of familial breakup in non-religious families than in religious families, yet it is not the true reason why anybody ought to seek intimacy with God. It would also be a rationalization if I were to say that the reason I am opposed to abortion is because the birth rate in Canada is too low to be able to support social insurance, the Canadian equivalent of U.S. Social Security, since old age pensions depend on new active workers, at least replacing old inactive workers, and in effect, paying for the retirees' withdrawals from the pension fund. Now, indeed, that might be a bad effect of abortion policies that lower the national birth rate. Nonetheless, that is not the true reason for moral opposition to abortion. The true reason for opposition to abortion is that every human life has the right not to be harmed, killing being the most extreme form of harm there is, because he or she is a person created in the image of God. That means the human creature most uniquely reflects the ultimacy of the Creator God, ultimacy that maximally makes a claim on our active respect, minimally on our passive restraint. When faced by that ultimacy, even when faced by the reflection of that ultimacy, we only have duties. Therefore, there is all the difference in the world between a rationalization for the prohibition of abortion and a metaphysical moral reason for it. Abortion, like its prohibition, though, has both its reasons and rationalizations. Lethally claiming an innocent life is like killing a prince when one's true intent, one's real reason, is to kill the king, whose kingship is most directly reflected in the prince, who most clearly bears the likeness of the king. But the king himself seems to be beyond the reach of any of his subjects. Therefore, since the king loves his child, who is his very image, has not the king made himself vulnerable in the way love makes anyone who loves vulnerable? So perhaps the way to assault the king is to kill what he seems to love best. Think of King David's lament for his son Absalom, murdered by his jealous general Joab in 2 Samuel 19:11, when the king says, "Oh, would it be that I had died instead of you?" And wouldn't Cain's killing of his brother Abel be Cain's revenge on God for having favored Abel over himself? As W.H. Auden famously put it in his poem, September 1st, 1939, "For the error bred in the bone of each woman and of each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone." Therefore, an assault on a human person, in the deepest sense, is meant to be an assault on God, perhaps because that person contemplating killing feels so unloved by God. Isn't that the most extreme way of acting as if God is dead, namely trying to kill God with grief? Accordingly, could we not say that the real object of the assault, which abortion no doubt is the God who seems to love this new person more than he loves me? As Proverbs 17:5 says, "Whoever reviles the weakest one, haloig l'rosh, reviles his maker." Close quote. Intending to kill God is a reason for committing feticide, albeit an evil reason. Such an evil reason, when properly understood, can only be refuted by arguing that what it intends cannot be true. In this case, God will not be killed, will not only live forever, but will avenge the death of the human victim of this intended, attempted, yet ultimately unsuccessful deicide. As T.S. Eliot put it in his 1936 play, Murder in the Cathedral, dealing with the murder of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas à Becket, quote, "Those who deny thee could not deny if thou didst not exist, and their denial is never complete, for if it were so, they would not exist." Close quote. Now, if all of this sounds too theological for secular ethical discourse, it could well be said that secular psychological notions of homicide are adaptations of theological notions of patricide and fratricide, notions which help persons gain insight into the deeper psychic struggles involved in their own agonizing moral choice whether to kill or not to kill. Moreover, these psychological adaptations of originally theological issues work best when they recognize themselves to be adaptations rather than a new psychology employed to explain away what are considered to be old myths. All this is helped by a phenomenological examination of what might well be occurring both consciously and subconsciously in the mind of somebody struggling with whether or not to take a human life. Such examination brings the gravitas and historical depth of theology to moral psychology. In fact, this is the sort of thing called for by one of Professor George's favorite contemporary philosophers, the late Elizabeth Anscombe, who in her tour de force, her 1958 essay, Modern Moral Philosophy, there in the very first sentence wrote, quote, "It is not profitable for us at present to do moral philosophy unless we have an adequate philosophy of psychology." Perhaps you would say theology of psychology. Now, those unaware or refuse to consider their metaphysical or existential reason for committing feticide frequently rationalize their act by presuming it is morally neutral. They do this by denying human personhood to the fetus to be killed or who has been killed already. They usually say something like fetuses are nothing but tissue. Accordingly, for them, abortion supposedly has no more moral significance than getting a haircut. But isn't that the grossest rationalization possible, even for them? That is, to make abortion a choice having no moral grounds or consequences. Yet one can refute this type of rationalization by arguing that inasmuch as the person making this kind of rationalization himself or herself began their life as just such a fetus, would they have wanted to be treated as a piece of tissue rather than as a person? As the Talmud put it, the most basic moral admonition might be, quote, "What you would hate to have done to you, do not do to somebody else." Moreover, even if the person so rationalizing is suicidal, assuming that he or she wishes to have been aborted himself or herself, do they really want for a life that has not yet suffered anything what they want for their own tortured existence? And even if the question to the answer is yes, which seems to have been the answer Hitler would have given at the time he shot himself, then there is no counter-argument that can or should be made when death is chosen for its own sake. Nevertheless, we can assume that very few people have sunk to that level of absolute nihilism. Now, there's another type of rationalization that is not just a diversion, but which is misleading. That is when reasons are given that are not just inessential, but which are false. Such a false reason would be to say that abortion is to be proscribed because women should be forced to bear children as their punishment for having indulged their sexual desires, especially if they're unmarried. To be sure, having sex outside of marriage, whether one is female or male, does constitute the sin of fornication, both Jewish and Christian traditions. Nevertheless, bearing a child conceived through fornication is not one's punishment for having had sex and gotten pregnant. In fact, one could say that bearing a child so conceived rather than aborting it lessens the earlier sin by not allowing it to lead to the greater sin of abortion. This prevents what the Talmud describes as, quote, one sin bringing another sin in its wake. Unfortunately, though, too many religious people, and here we have to look at our own folks, have fallen for this rationalization of the prohibition of abortion. Now, we all recognize that giving blatantly false reasons like the one about pregnancy being punishment for sin is used by many of our political opponents to castigate those of us who are pro-life, charging that our real reasons for our stands on issues of public morality like abortion, that they are really our motives in wanting to ram our religion down everyone else's throat. Along these lines, we are accused of having an unhealthy, puritanical attitude towards sex, and we are accused of unjustly favoring the punishment of women while exonerating by a notorious double standard the men who impregnated these women. That taking such false charges to be a challenge to our rational powers can spur us on to refute these charges by discovering more persuasive reasons for our opposition to abortion. That is far better than simply condemning our opponents as being anti-religious or anti-biblical. That, in fact, might be true about them, but on the issue of abortion, we are not making a strictly theological point. That is a point based on the authority of a particular tradition, a particular revelation, and the particular tradition of its transmission and interpretation. We are making a universal moral point for which theology provides some valuable phenomenological insights. As for the relation of theology and morality, that will have to be pondered when talking with the members of our own religious communities, that is those Jews and Christians who still appreciate and respect theological reasoning. Our thinking through the traditional prohibition of abortion in order to discover the true reason for it can also help us to correct those within our own traditions who entertain erroneous theological views about the prohibition of abortion, such as the one that regards pregnancy and childbirth as punishments for sexual sin, especially when the sinners are women. We can do that by better explicating the reason why we think abortion has been prohibited in our respective traditions, which is the same reason why any other person from any other tradition ought not participate in abortion, or even give any support whatsoever to those who perform abortions, to those who request such abortions be performed, thus making these unborn children, whether theirs or somebody else's, their victims. The prohibition of abortion is the type of norm that, in the words of the Talmud, quote, had it not been written in scripture, then reason would have required that it be written regardless. The prohibition of abortion, in fact, is considered by the Talmud to be a subset of the universal prohibition of shedding innocent blood, shfichut damim, which is the same prohibition for which Cain was held responsible by God for the murder of his brother Abel, and that was long before the commandment, thou shalt not murder, was revealed to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. In fact, there is precedent in the Jewish tradition, although by no means unanimity, for seeing Cain's violent act to be the first manifestation of original sin, which is endemic in human nature per se, rather than Adam and Eve's eating the forbidden fruit, which some see as a euphemism for erotic sex. Thus, we should not only employ our rational powers to bring the universal moral teachings of our traditions into secular public space, and that does not require that that anybody has to accept their authority, but we should also employ them to correct the errors of fanaticism, triumphalism, and superstition in our own religious communities. In that way, then, we correct others and ourselves using the same type of reasoning. Indeed, this is the logic of Kant's first formulation of the categorical imperative, the criterion of universalizability, namely that we are to include ourselves in what we require of all other rational beings like ourselves. Furthermore, we need to carefully differentiate such true reasons for universally moral practices from the type of historically particular reasons that are invoked to explain such strictly religious proscriptions as the Jewish prohibition of eating or even possessing leavened bread, chametz, during the 8 days of Passover, or the Catholic prohibition of treating a consecrated host as if it were an ordinary piece of bread. Surely we do not see it to be the business of any secular society to enforce these strictly religious norms, which can only be binding on the members of the traditional religious community to whom they were given by divine revelation in history. They are clearly distinct from universal moral norms that are first discovered by rationally, morally earnest human beings through what we now call public reasoning. That is the type of reasoning employed in social discourse, most famously showed in the public dialogical career of Socrates. This is important to show when we are accused by our enemies of attempting to impose our religion on everyone. But when we are so accused, we need to show that what we do see as a moral law to be enforced even by a secular society, and what we do not see as a moral law, and how and why we differentiate between these two kinds of law. Moreover, those of us who are theologians need to show how these moral norms were not invented by historical revelation, our Torah or Lex Divina, but rather that they are presupposed by historical revelation. That is quite different from seeing universal morality be some sort of diluted form of revelation or theological apology in the more pejorative sense of apology. Indeed, we need this type of theological perspicacity not only to prevent our morality from being made out to be covert theology, but also to understand the proper relation of theology and morality within our own religious traditions. 5, how much theoretical difference? We have seen how Professor George and I differ on the theoretical question of the relation of right and good, and that it is a relation that must be seen as hierarchical, even though Professor George regards basic human goods themselves to be incommensurate, that is non-hierarchical. Either right is assumed to be for the sake of good, or good is assumed to be for the sake of right. Nevertheless, a theoretical difference like this between Professor George and myself only needs to lead to practical difference if our theoretical differences were more than divergent, but if they were truly contradictory. In other words, practical difference would have to result somehow or other if what I say is a right or a justified claim, Professor George were to say is a wrong or an unjustified claim. Or practical difference would have to result if what Professor George says is a good, that is, what is to be done for its own sake, I were to say is an evil, that it which is not to be done. But that is not the case. So Professor George would not say that my assertion that every human life has the right not to be harmed, thus entailing the practical duty not to kill it, is wrong. He wouldn't say that's wrong, any more than I would say that his assertion that human life is an irreducible, non-instrumental good could ever be an evil to be eliminated. Inasmuch as our respective theoretical positions do not contradict each other, thus not requiring an either-or choice between them, accepting one and thereby rejecting its opposite, they need not lead to any significant practical differences. Instead of being theoretical differences of kind, they are only differences of degree, as are our few and minor practical differences. Accordingly, our theoretical differences suggest a certain theoretical pluralism, but which is prevented from sliding into moral relativism nonetheless, because they are different theoretical approaches for the explication and intelligent application of the same practical norms. But if that is the case, why bother with such theoretical pluralism? Isn't it a needless divergence from the type of political unanimity needed for our battles on behalf of what is evidently right and good in practice? Why not simply adopt one theoretical approach according to political criteria, namely, whose approach is likely to get the largest hearing, often based on the personal status of the one who formulated it and proclaimed it? Why not make theoretical effectiveness our criterion for choosing a particular ethical theory? In other words, isn't political strategy better than theoretical reflection in many cases of practical action in public? The reason for not succumbing to this political temptation is that adoption of such a practical stance would turn our arguments of principle ad rem into arguments based on personal, often professional, authority ad hominem. One might even say that they would become like John Rawls's notion of overlapping consensus, agreeing to agree. That would turn our rational arguments into political slogans, the type of political slogans like a woman's absolute right over her own body, for example, that require prima facie acceptance and then attempt to silence any further debate. Conversation stoppers, in the words of the late Richard Rorty. Therefore, there is an intellectual necessity for continuing theoretical reflection and even debate, both apart from and part of immediate consideration of which theoretical view leads to the most coherent practical conclusion. Our theories need constant refinement and reconsideration, and that can only come about when we argue for what is more cogent or less cogent with our colleagues than for am I incorrect and you are mistaken conclusion. There are times when Professor George and I have to differ on what is the more cogent theoretical approach to the presentation of an agreed upon practical norm, his or mine. Nevertheless, that will not mean either of us should dismiss the other permanently or even temporarily. For there are times when I might well have to admit that his theory provides a better reason for the norm at hand than mine, just as he might well have to admit that my theory provides a better reason for the norm at hand than his. And the fact that neither of us can be so theoretically conclusive so as to exclude the other, even temporarily, keeps Robert George and me, and many of you here today, within the same intellectual community. And God willing, may that continue for many years to come. Thank you.